Hi, I'm Maria Bruno with the Department of American Thought and Language, and I want to welcome you to the Michigan Writers Series. Tonight we have Pamela Ditchoff, who is a resident and a native of East Lansing. She received her BA in Communication Arts and an MA in Creative Writing from Michigan State University. Pamela's poetry and short stories have appeared in anthologies from St. Martin's Press and Paper Mache Press, as well as numerous literary magazines. She has written two teaching texts for Interact Publishing, and her awards and honors include the Chicago Review Award for Fiction, Eve of St. Agnes Awards, a John Ciardi Scholarship at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and a Walter Dagen Fellowship at the Sewanee Writers Conference. Pamela is the author of The Mirror of Monsters and Prodigies, published by Coffee House Press. Booklist said that the book was well-researched and well-written. This engrossing novel is a truly stunning debut work. The New York Times wrote, "This is a daring subject for a first novel, and Ms. Ditchoff is superb at taking on a variety of voices, presenting us with an extremely literate Ripley's, believe it or not." Her latest novel, Mrs. Beast, is being represented by Jane Distel Literary Management.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you, Peter Berg, for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here tonight, and I appreciate your coming on a night where the weather isn't so great, and MSU, U of M's tomorrow, go Spartans, yeah, yeah. I guess I want to say a little bit about the book first. Sometimes at readings I've just launched into the characters, and then people are very confused and don't know what I'm talking about. I want to say it took 3 years of research to write The Mirror of Monsters and Prodigies, and the reason for this is that all of the characters in this book are in historical record. They are not fictional people. The events and the customs in each time period are authentic to history, and 99.9% of that research was done right here at this wonderful library. We're really very fortunate to have one of the best college libraries in the country right here. A lot of research and special collections also in the library. The Mirror of Monsters and Prodigies is a fictionalized oral history of human oddities. It begins with Numotu, who was a dwarf and keeper of the royal wardrobe for Pharaoh Pepi II. And he was so beloved by the pharaoh that the pharaoh erected a tomb for him when he died. And the tomb was featured in National Geographic 3 or 4 years ago. It ends in the 1970s when the sideshow and carnival had pretty much vanished from America. The book's divided into five sections. The beginning is ancient voices. Then there are medieval voices, sovereign voices, the period of the kings and queens, so many of them kept dwarfs at court. Frederick of Prussia collected giants. Then after that is the greatest show on earth, the P.T. Barnum era. Then there is Congress of Wonders, and finally prodigal voices when the sideshow closed and medical science had made a lot of advancements so that a lot of conditions that people had that might have exhibited in sideshows could be corrected by medical or surgical means. I'm going to read a little bit from three different sections in the book, and this first section I'm going to read is titled Aesop and Dicho, and it takes place on the island of Samos, 500 BC. We were both slaves a year ago, both purchased by Xanthus the philosopher. Now Aesop is guest of the royal palace in Lydia, preparing a journey to Babylon financed by King Croesus. I'm still in Samos, slave to the insatiable desire of Arista, Xanthus Rattlebone Shrew of a wife. I'd seen her at the market 2 days before I was sold. Her eyes gleamed like Cisteria's when they fell upon me. Her fingers dug into Xanthus' arm, and she pulled me aside and whispered in his ear. The next day, Xanthus returned, his purse fat with coins, students at his heels. 3 new slaves were brought to the block, one of whom I'd never seen the like, Aesop. His coloring was dark, his nose flat and without bridge, his lips hung swollen as if stung by a swarm of bees. These features were set in a long, gourd-shaped head, and his squat torso curved to the left. His belly preceded the rest of his body, which sat on legs with knees opposing one another. Xanthus approached the block, and the slave on Aesop's right waved to him and boasted, "By me, I can do everything." The slave on Aesop's left leaned forward and said, "By me, I can do anything." Aesop choked with laughter, holding his round belly, his mouth wide open and gasping. The students, curious about the cause of his merriment, pressed Xanthus to inquire. Xanthus blinked his large eyes in confusion, then asked Aesop what services he could perform. Aesop replied, "Nothing at all. My companions, who can do everything and anything, have left nothing for me to do." "Which shall you choose, to doubt everything or to believe anything, are two equally convenient solutions. Both dispense with the necessity of reflection." Xanthus purchased Aesop, and off they trotted, engaged in serious conversation. Xanthus returned early the next morning before the market opened, looking sheepish and without his entourage. He purchased me privately. Upon arrival at his fine, whitewashed home, I noticed a curtain drawn back. Arista's dark eyes and hawk nose peered from behind it. I saw Aesop also squatted in a vegetable garden, humming to himself as he pulled weeds. Xanthus eagerly went to speak with him, leaving me on the stoop. Thus my work began. On nights when Xanthus wasn't away, which were rare, and I was reprieved from the labors of the mistress' bed, Aesop entertained me with stories. He has remarkable talent for telling tales. He told me of the greeting he received from Arista. You see, the day Aesop was bought, she'd sent Xanthus to market to purchase me. When she saw Aesop, she screamed, "Is this a man or a beast?" Then she loosed her rage upon Xanthus, who turned to Aesop with pleading eyes. Aesop said, "From lying at the mercy of fire, water, and a wicked woman, God deliver us." That he chose to quote a truly revered philosopher was a jab wasted on Xanthus. Aesop usually is not so blunt. He veils his intent in animal parables to reveal the truth of human nature. Being so offensive to the eyes, if he offended the ears as well with undecorated truth, he'd be struck dead. I don't have Aesop's wit. I have beauty, and long for the day I'm old and wrinkled, sent out of the rich houses into the fields of labor. Born to a court slave in Athens, I was put on the blocks at age 10. The man who purchased me collected beautiful young boys. When one of them slit the master's throat as he snored contentedly in the boy's arms, we were all sold to pay the master's debts. Since then, I've been in as many households as there are months in the year. My masters and mistresses clothe me in silk, bid me bathe in perfumed oils, and mount gleaming silver mirrors beside the beds. I hate my image, which is so unlike me that their praise of it mocks me. What deception wins, cruelty must keep. Beauty perverts. In order to justify their lust, they idealize me, and when I disappoint them by offering my heart, I'm sold again. Aesop, too, was born a slave in Thrace, an object of jest and disgust, likened to beast, and he has won the respect and admiration of kings. I miss his stories, but I'm happy for his good fortune. I picture him at King Croesus' side, telling the fable of Aesop and Dicho, which he might title The Frog and the Cistern. Arista. Good riddance to the croaking toad, big mouth forever flapping. Aesop made my husband look the fool, as if Xanthus needed any help. Praise Zeus for sending the eagle, otherwise Xanthus never would have parted with Aesop. During our spring festival, an eagle swooped down and snatched from the altar the ring that bears the seal of Samos. A short time later, a slave appeared with the ring, claiming it had been dropped into his hands by an eagle in flight. The citizens took this event as an augury of calamity to the state and turned to Xanthus for interpretation. Of course, he had no idea and put them off by begging time for deliberation. My husband, the great philosopher, will gladly pontificate for hours on the nature of government, things celestial and terrestrial, and to a herd of sycophantic boys. However, this official request sunk Xanthus into a depression so deep he threatened to swallow poison. Who was close by, listening at doorways, ready with a solution? Aesop. He has a way with animals. I'd wager he trained that bird to steal the ring and deliver it to his own hands, then put it into the hands of a slave along with words for its mouth, just as he put words into Xanthus' mouth to present to the council. Does it surprise you that Aesop convinced Xanthus to say the augury was best interpreted by a slave? Ha! Aesop said only if he were free could he be qualified for the function of interpretation. The council granted his freedom, and Aesop spoke thus. The eagle represents royalty, and dropping the seal in the hands of a slave portends loss of liberty. A fierce prince has his eye on Samos. Sure enough, within days, Croesus of Lydia demanded a tribute from Samos, and without such, war was imminent. You know as well as I these slaves' gossip. It's thick as honeycombs between them. Aesop, with his big ears so low to the ground, would have learned of Croesus' plan weeks ago. Where is Aesop now? A lapdog in Lydia, petted and pampered by Croesus, while Xanthus is as impotent as a dead fledgling in the nest and Dicho's cup is nearing the dregs. Aesop's criminator at Delphi. I did it. Put the cup in Aesop's pack. But I didn't know the purpose, I swear. If only he'd kept still, if he'd kept his lips quiet. I keep quiet. I know my place. I'm servant to the priests who interpret the inspired words of the oracle Pythia. At dawn I rise in silence, follow the priest who follow Pythia to the fountain of Castilia. There she bathes before donning her crown of laurels. Then we climb the slopes of Parnassus to the temple of Apollo. I help the lady into her three-legged chair, which straddles a chasm in the rock face. She closes her eyes and inhales deeply. Multitudes await the moment her body will shake and her mouth will utter the divine words of Apollo. None but the priest can understand and interpret her words. Many people come from distant lands to put questions to the oracle. I've heard countless answers, and I can make no sense of them, but I'm a stupid boy, and I don't ask questions. I see hundreds come and go through Delphi, and rarely do I remember a face, unless it's a lovely girl with an inviting smile. But who would not have noticed the deformed creature perched on the rock, watching the oracle for days and sniffing the air like a hound? When his vigil ended, he sought out the eldest citizen in Delphi, who happens to be my grandfather. He remembers the time before the oracle, before Apollo's temple was built, before the people came. He told me vapor had always risen from the oracle's chasm. As a boy, he'd seen sheep grazing near the chasm fall to the ground and twitch violently. I warned grandfather against talking about those days to strangers, but he's old and doesn't fear much. I learned from whispers in the temple that the deformed man was called Aesop, a freed slave renowned for his wit and wisdom. He'd stopped at Delphi on his way to Babylon. The magistrates were eager to hear him speak and urged him to address the people. His good words about the oracle repeated on his travels would bring many more believers to Delphi, their purchase rich with tribute. Aesop agreed, but his speech was his downfall. He said, "The curiosity that brought me to Delphi is akin to people standing by the sea who observe a thing far from shore. At first, they think it could be a wonder, but when it reaches shore, proves to be a heap of weeds and rubbish." The citizens were outraged, and the magistrates' faces flamed red. I should have guessed they would plot revenge. As Aesop readied to leave Delphi, I was sent to his quarters with orders to slip the gold temple cup into his pack. He was apprehended outside the city, charged with sacrilege, jailed and condemned to death, sentenced to be thrown from a precipice of Parnassus. After the judgment was proclaimed, Aesop waved his arms, screwed up his face, frightened the magistrates into silence, and said, "A rabbit fleeing from an eagle took sanctuary in a ditch occupied by a beetle. The eagle flapped the beetle aside and devoured the rabbit. The insulted beetle planned a revenge. Watched the eagle fly to her nest, then continually climbed there while the eagle hunted and rolled the eggs out of the nest. The eagle appealed to Zeus, who allowed her to lay her next clutch of eggs in his lap, but the beetle contrived a way to make Zeus rise from his throne and destroy the eggs unaware. Zeus, upon hearing the beetle's case, found the eagle to be the aggressor and acquitted the beetle." The citizens pondered this. Zeus's name had been called, but Aesop didn't stop there, didn't keep silent. He sputtered, "Don't flatter yourselves that the oppressors of the innocent shall escape divine vengeance." He turned his long head, found me in the crowd, and gave me a wink. I wanted to throw myself off a precipice. Surely he knew I'd put the cup in his pack. Up the mountain, I followed the procession, and though the sun shone brightly overhead, I shivered at Aesop's piercing shouts as he was dragged toward death. An old man, spent all his life in the country, wished to see the city before he died. Friends loaned asses that knew well the road. Terrible storm. Asses fell into a pit, crushing the old man. With his dying breath, said, "Miserable bastard I am to die by the lowest of beasts. And my fate is worse, in the hands of ignorant, corrupt, drunk, and blind, no conception of humanity or honor. Gods will not suffer my blood unavenged." His cursing diminished with each thud against the rocks. A mob stood at the precipice edge, peering down, and nearly jumped out of their skins when Aesop's echo screamed, "Blood unavenged." Then there was silence, a silence deep and eternal as the grave. This is from the section on sovereign voices. It takes place in the court of King James I in London, 1616. The Mask of Blackness. The storm will howl and the curtain rise to reveal the daughters of Niger huddled within an enormous shell. The shell appears to float upon painted wooden waves that harbor gruesome sea monsters and mermen. Then I, William Parsons, will rise from the sea. Look on this grimace. Are you afeard? Do your knees quake in the presence of Oceanus, Titan of the sea? Who else could play the part? I'm the only giant in King James' court, aren't I? What say you of my costume? For a man of my dimensions, the cloth is sparse. I discern the purpose. To display as much of my strength as possible, save pitching the ladies into swoons. Played truly, Oceanus would don nary a thread. If I played true, the married ladies would retire after the mask and kick their puny husbands out of bed, wouldn't they? 'Twas an Igo Jones done me up as Oceanus. He devised the costume and scenery. There he stands yonder with Ben Jonson, author of the mask. God give me patience. If they change my lines and movements once again, I'll quit the show. Rather than bickering like two old hens, they should be jumping with joy. They'd fairly chime with coins. The Majesties spare no expense on entertainments. At last, King James enters the hall. The mask will soon commence. Tonight we celebrate Twelfth Night and honor the appointment of Prince Charles as Duke of York. Excuse me. Have a peek through the curtain. He's the dark-haired boy dressed in gold satin. Bows upon his boots. Note his sober expression. Such a fine laddie. He sits at the king's right hand. On the left is Villiers, a dandy with the muscles of a girl. He is indeed the glass wherein the noble youth dress themselves. A pretty young man, the current court favorite. Oftentimes, whilst I guard the royal bedchamber, 'tis Villiers who tickles the king's fancy within. He best keep in mind the last favorite who now weeps foul from a tower cell. Queen Anne partakes in the mask as a daughter of Niger, her alabaster face and limbs painted black. 'Twas her design that she and her ladies appear as blackamoors. Poor Johnson had to script words that made sense of blackamoor women presented at English court. Here's the gist of the plot. The daughters are in despair after hearing of the superior beauty of nymphs in other lands, so they set sail in quest of a place where they might be cured of their blackness. Only through the superior strength and power of Oceanus, who guides their shell, does this unhappy group land in England. Then from behind a cloud, the goddess of the moon happily declares her prophecy fulfilled. The daughters of Niger have arrived at Britannia, a land governed by a bright sun, meaning King James, whose beams shine day and night and are of force to bleach an Ethiop and revive a corpse. Betwixt we two, I'd be happier lifting an ale with the yeomen of the guard. Good fellows each, and ever at the ready to engage in games of strength. All considered, the stage is not an unpleasant change from my duties as royal porter. Least I'm paid handsomely here, for at Cow Lane End, Bartholomew Fair, I was lucky to earn tuppence a day. 'Twas at the fair King James hired me after receiving great pleasure from walking neath my outstretched arm. Among my possessions is a handbill of that year which reads, Miracula Natura, being that giant-like young man aged 23 years last June, born in Ireland of such a prodigious height and bigness and every way proportionable that the like hath not been seen in England in the memory of man. He is to be seen at Cow Lane End in Bartholomew Fair, where his picture hangs out. Court of King Philip, Madrid, Spain, 1624. Velázquez. What a remarkable subject he'd be. Look, my easel quakes as Parsons walks through the hall. I gauge his height at 7 feet. His skin would appear sickly white if not for the numerous freckles. That bush of hair is closer to orange than red, wouldn't you say? As is the mustache he gnaws between his large square teeth. His eyes are small and copper-colored like fox eyes. Have you heard the bawdy tavern songs he sings, swaggering through the streets? The man is full to bursting with himself. Could you guess one sight that takes the wind from his sail? A dwarf. When he encounters a court dwarf, he tugs his ear, mumbles little people, and turns his step in the opposite direction. I'd like to paint the giant before he leaves Madrid, though I doubt he'd be still long enough for sketching. Then, too, permission is required from Charles, Prince of Wales, whom Parsons serves. The prince and his two companions, Villiers and Parsons, rode to Madrid in a mere 16 days. Have you seen the horse Parsons rode? An immense animal, yet its every bone must ache. The purpose of the royal visit is to woo King Philip's sister, the Infanta Maria, as bride. King James will be disappointed. His son-in-law Frederick lost the Rhenish Palatinate to Spain, and this marriage would regain what was lost. Though Philip keeps Charles distracted, prolongs his stay, concessions and promises in mind, Maria will never be allowed to marry a Protestant. Perhaps I could speak to Villiers about painting Parsons. He's the king's closest advisor and was recently made Duke of Buckingham. How would I pose Parsons? I ask my subjects to choose their stance and setting. Doing so, I paint them as they allow themselves to be seen. A court painter, most of my canvases portray the royals, but because the family finds pleasure in the company of dwarves, I'm able to paint them also. Three of these portraits hang on the south wall. Would you care to have a look? The first is Francisco de Mora, a boy of 14. He chose his favorite place, a window nook in the castle atop a pile of cushions with a spacious view of the hills. His shirt and robe are common cloth, soft and loose. He holds a deck of tarot cards given to him by his mother, who dwells in those hills. Yes, he does look like a very young child, except for the curve of his mouth. Next is Don Diego de Acedo. His clothes are very fine. He's as meticulous in his appearance as he is with his figures. 25 years he has served at court as secretary to the king. Scattered before him are the tools of his profession, inkwell, quill, book, and ledgers. You should meet this man. His intellect is most vigorous and his conversation stimulating. Last is Don Sebastian de Mora, who possesses a warrior's face. He sits upon the floor, his short legs thrust out before him, fist clenched at his side, his dark eyes challenging. Even his beard and mustache are fierce, I think. But I explain too much. The court dwarves offer sanity amidst pervasive madness. These men are known for speaking the truth, though sometimes cloaked in the guise of jest. This is an old tradition, kings having dwarves and fools about, and Philip's court houses a great many. Once when King Philip was visited by the Duke of Modena, he dressed two dwarfs as Castilian kings and set them on steps of the throne while Philip and his guest attended the bullfights. Understand that a king must be on guard as so much depends on his personal favor. Those close to him obscure the truth to maintain good grace. The dwarf can be coddled by the king without arousing jealousy among courtiers and can speak clearly without fear of retaliation, an enviable position. And if you'd like to see those three portraits in the art library in the books on Velázquez, you will find the three portraits of these court dwarves. And I'd like to read a couple of selections from P.T. Barnum's era. Before Barnum had the circus, he had the American Museum, a huge building in New York that he purchased from the Scudder sisters. And this is the American Museum fire, November 1865. The firemen. All them freaks is saved, but we had a divil of a time with a giant gal. On me mother's grave, I swear that gal stands 8 feet tall and weighs 400 pounds. Only doors in the building that weren't aflame were too small for her to fit through, and the stairs would have broke under her even if she could have got to them. As if things weren't bad enough, wasn't a spare man, pump, or horse that wasn't fighting a fire elsewheres. You see, a band of Confederate agents bent on doing damage because our Union boys was thumping them down south slipped into the city and began setting fires. 19 hotels, the Winter Garden, Niblo's Garden, ships on the North River, and this here Barnum Museum. Some snake of a Reb flung a glass bomb on the grand staircase, and the place went up like a tinderbox. Now this is for sure. He picked his target. Mr. Barnum ain't shy about his opinions. Many's the time he spoke out against Southern slaveholders and their copperhead sympathizers in the North. He paid for volunteers to serve in the Union Army. And in that museum, he puts on dramas of a patriotic nature about war heroes. The wife and I saw one about the drummer boy, Robert Hendershot, a wee lad whose drum was shattered by a Confederate shell while crossing the Rappahannock River. Brought a tear to the wife's eye, I don't mind saying. We didn't think we could rescue the giant gal. We could see her wailing and sweating inside her room, and at her side was a man that looked like a walking skeleton. We motioned for him to come out, but that skinny feller wouldn't leave her, just kept patting her hand and trying to comfort her with words that couldn't be heard over the crackling flames and fallen timbers. Then a group of the freaks pointed out a loft derrick nearby, and me and the men set it up alongside the building with a strong tackle. We used our axes to break a big hole in the wall by the gal's room. Took four of us to fasten that tackle around her, what with her flailing about, scared out of her wits. While 18 men held the other end of the line, we swung her out and lowered her down to the street where crowds were clapping their hands and whistling. I picked up the skinny feller who'd collapsed on the floor. He was light as a feather, and carried him outside where he shortly recovered. Alta was a magazine. New York, March 27th, 1867. Dear readers, now that Barnum is running for Congress, anything connected with him is imbued with a new interest. Therefore, I went to his museum yesterday along with the other children. There is little or nothing in the place worth seeing, and yet how it draws. It was crammed with both sexes and all ages. One could keep on going upstairs from floor to floor and still find scarcely room to turn. There are numerous trifling attractions there, but if there was one grand absorbing feature, I failed to find it. Barnum's museum is one vast peanut stand now with a few cases of dried frogs and other wonders scattered here and there to give variety to the thing. There are some cages of ferocious lions and other wild beasts, but they sleep all the time. And also an automatic card writer, but something about it is broken and it don't go now. Also a good many bugs with pins stuck through them, but the people do not seem to enjoy bugs anymore. In some large glass cases are some atrocious waxen images done in the very worst style of art. Queen Victoria is dressed in faded red velvet and glass jewelry and has a bloated countenance and a drunken leer in her eye that reminds one of convivial Mary Holt when she used to come in from a spree to get her ticket for the county jail. And that accursed eyesore to me, Tom Thumb's wedding party, which airs its smirking imbecility in every photograph album in America, is not only set forth here in ghastly wax, but repeated. Why does not some philanthropist burn the museum again? Mark Twain. And that is a direct quote. That is what he actually wrote. Now I'd like to read just the first few 10 pages or so of my new novel titled Mrs. Beast. And as Marie said, this is currently being sent around, making the rounds. Mrs. Beast. I should say this is the story of Beauty from Beauty and the Beast. And it takes up after, about 3 months after she married the prince. And as you'll see, she isn't very happy with that. I'll just go. Mrs. Beast. I learned the truth at 17 that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who marry young and then retire. Janice Ian. Shortly after, happily ever after. Inside the white walls of Palace Fleur de Cour, Princess Beauty stands in the great hall with her back to Prince Runyon, her tulle and silk gown hiked up at the waist. She imagines that at this moment the girls of her childhood village are gazing contentedly out of cottage windows, a babe underfoot, another on the breast as their husbands sow spring fields. Prince Runyon reclines on a brocade divan, contemplating beauty's rosy posterior. A halo of wheat blonde hair frames his angular face. He yawns and exhales with exaggerated boredom. Now I want you to bend over. Beauty purses her cherry pink lips, gathers her lustrous chestnut curls, and obeys. She closes her eyes and pictures the last time they'd mated, when he was still the beast, and they had rolled and growled on a secluded moss bed like two badgers, the scent of his musk bag stinging her nostrils, his coppery fur clutched in her fist the moment his fangs gripped her clavicle muscle. Runyon, the prince, has only twice bedded his wife since their wedding night 3 months ago. While the beast had been content with austere surroundings, the prince prefers opulence. Now hundreds of candles light dozens of chandeliers, Persian carpets lay wall to wall beneath red velvet love seats, and pots of scented civet fat vaporize in corners. Nude statues cast in lewd poses are staggered throughout the great hall. Full-length mirrors line the walls, and a portrait of Prince Runyon hangs above each mirror. In the room's center is Runyon's divan, swagged in yellow silk. Beauty's back begins to ache, but she's determined to please her husband. After all, Runyon had granted her request to spend a day together without the company of his fawning entourage. Since his transformation occurred, dukes, countesses, and royal wannabes are constantly dropping by the palace, buttering up Runyon with the finesse of a pâtissier. "Puis me and toi, wigwing," Runyon says, using the speech affectation popular among vain and bored nobles. Beauty has not been schooled in the art of seduction and had no such need when Runyon was his beastly self. However, she did promise to love, honor, and obey, and although fairy tale beauties are modest, they're also blindly obedient to husbands and fathers. She swallows the lump of pride rising in her throat and does as her husband commands. Muted waves of tittering and sniggering fill the great hall. A pair of mirthful eyes twinkle behind the holes of each of Runyon's portraits. They are not alone after all. Beauty snaps upright, then collapses in a faint. Outside the walls of Palace Fleur de Cour, northwest beyond the Rose Garden, is the last 20 miles of French fairy tale countryside that ends with the deep, icy river bordering Grimland. In the dense forest of Grimland, angst clings and spreads like lichen. Roaming and skulking among the trees are animals capable of speaking, granting wishes, and swallowing children. The place is lousy with frogs, witches, giants, dwarves, elves, and goblins, but fairy tale beauties are rare as 60-carat diamonds. Sharp objects to which beauties are especially vulnerable abound: knives, axes, spindles, thorns. Grim peasants and gentry dwell in burgs and villages below hilltop castles where kings exact impossible promises, queens plot infanticide, princes await adventures, and princesses await princes. And in her Art Deco palace atop Grimland's glass mountain, the highest and least accessible point in all of fairy tale domain, Elora the Enchantress is watching as Beauty falls to the floor. "Bricklebrit," Elora curses, and Croesus, the Abethan hound curled at her feet, spits out 3 gold coins. Elora woke in a mean mood. She'd fallen asleep in her spider-spun gown, and it had dissolved on her skin like day-old cotton candy. Head fuzzy, tongue furry, she regretted that third goblet of punch. Last night was the vernal equinox, and being the most mythical enchantress of the realm, Elora had been obliged to entertain Grimland's magic minions. The gingerbread witch sat in Elora's Duncan Grant chair, stinking of singed flesh and fuming over Hansel and Gretel. Rumpelstiltskin crabbed on the shortage of nubile miller's daughters while nervously picking dog hair from the Velcro strip that bound his two halves together. Old Mother Gothel, a blonde braid big as an anaconda wrapped around her neck, climbed Elora's stainless steel winding staircase, chanting, "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair." Godfather Death, reeking of cave dirt and candle wax, silenced her by drawing a lit taper from his trench coat, holding his fingers over the wick and fixing her with a stony glare. The Nixie of the mill pond, her voice a saccharine breeze, insisted something be done about the goddamn fairies pissing in my pond. The thirteenth wise woman still held a grudge over Sleeping Beauty, and the 12 others debated the definition of virtue. Is wealth a virtue? Is beauty a virtue? Is sweetness a virtue? Can casting a spell be a virtue? If they hadn't all been whining and griping, Elora wouldn't have laced the punch with powdered toad skin. She told them if they spent more time on quality control and less time flapping their gums, the answers would be plain as the wart on Mother Gothel's nose. When the punch kicked in, the gingerbread witch blew smoke rings from 9 orifices. Mother Gothel tied the braid to the railing and swung around the room, hooting like a gibbon. Rapunzel unfastened his Velcro, showing off his scar to the pond Nixie. Godfather Death brought in the Bremen Town musicians and led the 13 wise women in a conga line. It was last night's debate over whether a spell could be virtuous that had prompted Elora to conjure up Prince Runyon's palace, witness the debasement of beauty, and curse Bricklebrit. Elora snaps up a cup of Jamaican Blue Mountain, stares into the crystal ball, and a sneer curls her blackberry lips. Unconscious on the great hall floor, Beauty dreams of roses. She smells the branch of Floribunda her father picked from the beast's garden. She hears his voice, "Beauty, take these roses. They will cost your poor father dearly." Then he sobs out the story of his encounter with the beast and the price to be paid. She hears her sister Violet's voice, "See what this measly creature's arrogance has caused. Why didn't she settle for the same gifts as ours? Now she's going to be the cause of our father's death, and she doesn't even cry." Beauty feels anew the sting as her sister Daisy whips the rose branch against her bosom, and the thorn draws 3 drops of blood. The grim psychologist claims that a small amount of bleeding, 3 being the number associated in the unconscious with sex, prepares little beauties to accept this precondition for conception, because only after the bleeding of menstruation and hymen breaching is a child born, so bleeding is closely connected with a happy event. Beauty twitches as pain tugs her into consciousness. Her eyes open on the great hall ceiling and a blur of faces encircling her supine body. Prince Runyon is grinning, the tip of his tongue protruding from beneath his teeth. His eyes are crossed in concentration. "Ouch, a thorn is stuck in my skin," Beauty groggily surmises. She rolls her eyes downward to the source of her discomfort and sees Runyon puncturing her breast with an ink-dipped needle. He pauses and meets her widening eyes. "Do keep quiet, Dowing. Only we wedders to go." Beauty elbows to a seated position as Runyon's entourage simpers in admiration. "Such an artiste. Do me next." Beauty wets the hem of her petticoat with tears of humiliation, dabs her breast with a moist satin, reads the 3 letters, and does precisely as they suggest, R-U-N. After this, Beauty goes on a quest to find the enchantress that changed him to a beast and ask to change him back, and along the way she meets Snow White and Sleeping Beauty and Rapunzel and Cinderella and finds out what happened to them after Happily Ever After. Are there any questions I can answer for anyone?
What drew you first of all to write about dwarves in the first book? What was it about that?
It started with, I wrote a short story, 1990, I think, that was about the demise of the modern sideshow. It's actually in the last part of this book. And while I was researching that, I found references to a lot of other human oddities through history and started researching, and the voices were just there. Also, when I was very young, they still had sideshows at the county fairs. And I was born, I had a birthmark on my face. My parents had it removed when I was about six, I think, or five. Not that I was I didn't feel self-conscious about it or anything, but we were at the Ingham County Fair, and my dad had taken my brother and sister off to the rides, and I always got sick on rides, so I stayed with my mom. And there was, to our right, there was a bally, which is the stage where performers will give a little sample of what the show is going to be if you want to come inside. And there was a fat lady and a tattooed man and alligator woman and a thin man that drove spikes up his nose. And I went up to the stage and looked at them. I just thought they were amazing. I think children, of course, when we're children, we don't have all those filters yet. And if you have good parents, they don't say to you, "Don't stare at that poor, unfortunate person." At any rate, the tattooed man lifted me up on the stage, and the alligator woman asked if I wanted to feel her skin, that it was very soft, and I did, and it was. It's an absence of oil, the condition, and which can be treated now, of course. But they were very nice to me. I don't think they were nice to me because I had an obvious birthmark on my face. I think they were just very nice people, and they could see that I thought that they were wonderful. So I guess that probably has, in the back of my head, something to do with wanting to look into this now.
I was interested in your remark about the dwarf in the court, and that one of the reasons why the court may have been attracted to them is that they could have a relationship with them that wouldn't be under suspicion by other people, because mm-hmm. most people would consider these folks as oddities and not mm-hmm. to be...
And most of them considered that they were not much more intelligent than a talking parrot.
And did sometimes the dwarves play on that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm sure all the time. One of my favorite characters in the book is Valakoff, who was a companion to Peter the Great, a dwarf. Peter the Great was a lunatic. He was really crazy and had, well, he was brilliant too, but he had a very strange side. And the parties that his drunken synod would have were legendary. And all that research I found here in special collections.
It reminds me too, there's that Monty Python movie in which there's a whole troop of dwarves that lead this little boy through back through time.
Oh, yeah, that's with the ship and the building.
Yeah, with the ship and the whole thing.
What's the name of that? No, it's not Meaning of Life. Oh, yeah, it's fabulous. No, I saw that movie at the State Theater, which you probably don't, you remember the State Theater. It was on Abbott, where the bank is now, I think. Yeah. Something in Time. That was that's a great movie.
Okay.
Time Bandits.
Time Bandits.
Yeah, you should see that. Yeah, they were.
What authors influence you? What authors do you read that you appreciate and you think may influence the way that you write?
Juna Barnes, I would say. Nightwood, her novel Nightwood, I've read many, many times, and an amazing writer. I read T.C. Boyle. I like very much. Virginia Woolf. Everything.
Do you read fairy tales?
I did. Yes, I did. And if you read the original Grimm, they're very grim. I call them Grimm brothers. I think maybe the term Grimm came from the Grimm brothers. They have been, they're always cleaned up in most editions for kids, but the originals, yeah, really horrific. I know that Margaret Atwood, of course, did Robin's Egg or Blackbeard, or she did something on fairy tales, and Angela Carter is another writer that I liked her work very much on the dark side of fairy tales, but I didn't I didn't want to be overly dark. I wanted, if you stop and logically think about what would happen to these women who men, princes marry them only because of the way they look. You know, if Sleeping Beauty slept for 100 years and is woken with a kiss, and he says, "Marry me, you're gorgeous, I want you to be my wife." Well, then after a little while, he gets bored because she's stupid. She's been asleep for 100 years. She doesn't know what's going on. She leaves. You know, she tries to read and study and get caught up, and she gets sick, and the court physician prescribes opium, and she really likes that. She goes back to the kingdom of dreams, and of course everyone's dead that she knew, all her family's gone. And she starts growing poppies and is an opium addict. Snow White's back with the 7 dwarves and their 7 wives and a bunch of kids in a commune, dwarf commune, and she never goes anywhere, and she had a problem with cutting herself for a while, but she's over that now. So it's a bad thing. It's a very bad thing to teach our young women that if only I'm pretty enough, then I can get the prince and the castle and everything. And don't preach. It still goes on. And there's a lot of great things counteracting it, but media is so powerful. And the fashion magazines, the films, I mean, you know, Ever After, Drew Barrymore was very improvement in a strong character, but still, she's gorgeous. You know, and it was a nice movie, but I happen to think mine would be better. And I don't know if this will ever happen. Two Drivers Productions, which is Kate Driver and Minnie Driver, have Mrs. Beast. They're reading it. So maybe, but I doubt it. Movies like that never get made. We'll see. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming tonight. You're very welcome. I have some books here. I don't know what they sell for in the store. I think $12.95. Yeah, $12.95. But these are 10. If you would like a book, they're here. I brought some copies. So thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it very much.